Support for this podcast comes from Wise, the universal account that lets you send, spend, and receive money internationally. With one account for over 50 currencies, who's Wise made for? It's made for jet setters and slow travelers, for online marketplaces and real-life bazaars, for business in the city and pleasure on the coast. Wise is made for studying abroad and supporting your little brother's schooling back home. When you use Wise to manage your money across borders, you always get the mid-market exchange rate with no markups and no hidden fees. Join 13 million customers and learn how the Wise account could work for you at wise.com/world.
With setbacks on the battlefield, more Russians are turning against Vladimir Putin and his war, but there's not much they can really do about it.
Instead, Russians are turning off. They're not opposing Putin, but nor are they willing to support him anymore.
Also ahead, soaring electricity costs are crushing bakeries in France.
L'électricité pour moi.
This French baker says his electricity bill has quadrupled, and bakers like him are threatening to stop making their baguettes unless the government helps them out. Plus, not an ideal year for a dream European ski getaway. Record temperatures there are wreaking havoc on winter sports.
There is no snow. Literally, you can't ski here. There's just grass. It's just grass.
I'm Carol Hills. That's all ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Pope Benedict XVI was laid to rest today. His funeral was held in St. Peter's Square at the Vatican. Pope Francis led worshipers in prayer. Benedict made history when he resigned as the Pope in 2013, the first sitting Pope to do so in six centuries. After resigning, Benedict held the title of Pope Emeritus and continued to influence the Church. For more on his legacy, we're joined by Massimo Fagioli. He's a professor of historical theology at Villanova University, and he joins us from Italy. Massimo, let's start with the funeral. Describe the scene for us and what stood out for you.
It stood out that it was a much smaller crowd compared to 2005 when John Paul II had his funeral, and that it was a much somber, much more quiet and restrained ceremony. And the most important difference was that it was a funeral mass that it was not leading towards a conclave for the election of the new Pope, because there is already a sitting Pope, Pope Francis.
How do you see Benedict's overall legacy? I mean, will he be remembered most for resigning or something more?
I believe for something more. I mean, in terms of the papacy, it has been with many important decisions, especially on the front of the abuse crisis. But institutionally, it will be remembered for sure for the resignation. But let's remember that he became a certain kind of icon or a brand of Catholicism even before becoming Pope. He was already a well-known theologian in the late 50s, early 60s. He became the spokesperson for anti-liberal or non-progressive Catholicism. He has been extremely influential.
In contrast to Benedict, Pope Francis appears to engage more on the social issues of our time and is seen as more open-minded. Was there any conflict between the two men and their ideologies?
So there are certainly differences, but on most of them, there were no open conflicts. But there was one issue on which those visions collided, and it's the issue of the liturgy, how to celebrate Mass. One of the most consequential decisions made by Benedict was, as Pope in 2007, to allow Catholics to have access more easily to the Mass that is celebrated in Latin in the rite before the Second Vatican Council, 1963-64, which is one law that Pope Francis reversed in 2021.
Where does the Catholic Church go from here under the current leadership of Pope Francis? I mean, does Benedict's passing change anything or not?
Well, it changes something because a more conservative Catholic culture has lost its eponymous leader that was at the helm of a certain kind of theology and of worship style for almost half a century. What doesn't change is that in very wide circles within Catholicism, meaning bishops and the clergy, it is still very much Ratzinger's church.
So Pope Francis inherited many of the bishops that Pope Benedict appointed.
Absolutely, especially in the United States. Every time there is an election within the National Bishop Conference, those who are called Francis bishops, they always lose. And this still happens almost 10 years after his election.
Pope Francis has been observed to be in declining health. How strong is the speculation that he may choose to step down now that Pope Benedict has died?
I really don't see Pope Francis resigning and then burying himself in a monastery. He's a man of the streets, not a monk who's content with his books in the library.
Massimo Fagioli is a professor of historical theology at Villanova University. He's been speaking to us from Italy. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
While people in California are dealing with too much precipitation right now, Europeans are experiencing a very different sort of winter. Germany, Poland, Spain, and the Czech Republic have all broken records for unseasonably warm weather in recent days. That might be good news for those who hate the cold, but not so good for businesses that rely on winter tourism. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Berry reports.
Liverpudlian Christine Harrison has been flying to Le Prat de Lys, a ski resort in the French Alps, for the past 25 years.
It's a lovely little quiet French resort.
This year, though, there is a big problem.
You can't ski. Literally, there is no snow. There's just grass. It's just grass.
Harrison is on a winter holiday with her partner and two children, and she says she's never seen temperatures quite like this in January.
I've got the patio doors wide open. It's that warm. I'm on the balcony now. I've got bare feet. I've not even put any socks on. And it's 15 degrees.
That's almost 60 degrees Fahrenheit. Across Europe, ski resorts are struggling to cope with the unseasonably high temperatures. Some places in the Northern Alps and French Pyrenees have shut their doors completely, while holidaymakers are trying their luck at resorts located at higher altitudes. Earlier this week, Christine Harrison and her family headed up to the ski resort of Les Contamines, about an hour and a half from where they're staying.
At the top, there was snow. The minute you dropped to 2,000, 1,900, it was just rain. I mean, it was horrible. I mean, we managed to do about 4 hours and it was like, what were you even doing? It was just carnage.
Climate scientists say it's not only depressing for winter sports enthusiasts, it can be risky too.
There's more chance of avalanches and just skiing being more dangerous because snow and ice is less settled, less firm.
Klaus Dawes is a geopolitics professor at Royal Holloway University in London. The high temperatures aren't just being seen in Europe's mountain resorts. The mercury rose to 66 degrees Fahrenheit in Warsaw in Poland earlier this week, a city where temperatures usually hover around freezing at this time of year. In Bilbao in northern Spain, locals headed to the beach as temperatures reach levels usually seen at the height of summer. Klaus Dodd says these changes will have consequences far from the ski slopes.
Snow loss or ice loss also has implications for water supply, water security, and many of Europe's major rivers, such as the River Po in Italy or the Rhine, are dependent, of course, on alpine meltwater to replenish water levels.
Dodds points out that a warm winter season affects local economies too. Many towns in the mountainous regions of countries like France and Italy are dependent on winter tourism and snowy conditions for their survival. Sarah Burden has been living in Morzine, a traditional village nestled in the French Alps, for 17 years.
I mean, everyone is obviously very concerned because the economy here does turn very much around tourism. And while the summer is an important and very much growing part of the tourism here, the winter is still the main season.
Burden is communications manager at the local tourist office. She says the town is still open as there's snow on the higher slopes, but she says she's never seen a winter like this. In the last few years, the skiing village has tried to address its own impact on climate change. After all, artificial snow cannons and chairlifts are big gas guzzlers. Now solar energy powers some of the town's ski lifts and staff use GPS systems to locate exactly where artificial snow is needed. But there's still the problem of the biggest carbon footprint of all.
Most tourists coming here will actually fly, but we have also been working, obviously, with the European visitors on encouraging people to come by train.
Burden says the town of Mooresean is now concentrating on making the resort an all-year-round attraction. Still, some holidaymakers are trying to make the best of it, like Christine Harrison in Pradalee.
So we're going horse riding today. We'll probably go for a nice big walk tomorrow.
Harrison says they haven't yet decided if they'll come back next winter. Right now, she says, she's just looking forward to going home to Liverpool, where, as usual, the forecast is nothing but rain. For the World, I'm Orla Barry.
There's a rebellion looming in France by bakers. They say that making those beloved French pastries has become next to impossible because of soaring electricity prices. They're demanding government help and they're threatening the unthinkable, turning off their ovens. Jerry Haddon reports from Ombra, France.
For French baker Philippe Mendes, the sound of his electric ovens whirring to life used to be music to his ears. Now it's a source of stress. My electricity bill has gone up fourfold in the last 8 months, he says. That's besides the price hikes for my basic ingredients. The situation, he says, is becoming very complicated. Mendes opened his artisanal bakery 9 years ago in this small Alpine village. Business has been good until now. Inflation, the war in Ukraine, and the Europe-wide energy crunch have him at wit's end. My wife, Nathalie, has had to come into work, he says, as we've been forced to reduce our staff. If this crisis continues, he says, we'll have to lay off others. What's happening is a real shame, says Nathalie, slicing bread on the electric slicer. All of our bread is homemade. We strive for quality. But because of what's happening, she says, our hands are tied. We can't serve our clients. At the end of this week, the Mendeses say they'll have to raise prices by around 10%. They say they can only hope their customers will still come by. Because this is France, good bread isn't some luxury item. It's like water. You have it with every meal. Local worker Julien Brunier picks up two baguettes on his way home from work. He says he can't start his day without them. They're actually mini baguettes, he corrects me. Ficelle. In the morning, he says, rubbing his stomach, I toast them and eat them with butter and jam. Our bread is very important, says 80-year-old customer Giselle van Overberg, back inside the bakery. It's well known, she says, that the French baguette is the best in the world. You could chuck up such comments to national pride, but French bakers sell some 6 billion baguettes a year. And in December, the United Nations granted baguette baking World Heritage status. And each week on French TV,
Retour à Nantes, Franck et Vivian vont présenter à notre jury leur pain qui donne des biscottos.
There's a reality TV show. It's like MasterChef, but just for bread. Bakers are beloved in France, but they're not immune to the energy woes gripping the country. Electricity prices are set to rise further this winter as the government struggles to compensate for the loss of natural gas from Russia. In fact, the government warns there could be temporary blackouts later this month, but its message to bakers is, we've got your backs. We will not let our bakeries fail, said France's Minister of Finance, Bruno Le Maire, on the radio this week. We'll stand by them, he said, helping with concrete measures. Those include tax breaks and emergency subsidies, but French bakers say they need more. They speak of an emergency bailout check, says baker Philippe Mendes. But the problem is the red tape. I had to file an application about 6 inches thick, he says, and I still don't know if I'm getting anything. Mendes says he can hang on for another couple of months. After that, he says, he'll bake up his last batch of baguettes, then unplug his ovens for good. And that, he says, would be an existential catastrophe.
Le français, s'il mange pas de pain, il est mort, hein?
Because he half jokes, the French will die without their bread. For the World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Embrun, France.
Russian President Vladimir Putin is calling a brief holiday ceasefire as Orthodox worshippers prepare to celebrate Christmas this weekend. Just ahead, we look at where things stand as the war in Ukraine presses on. You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Russian President Vladimir Putin has ordered a 36-hour ceasefire in Ukraine. It's set to coincide with the Orthodox Christmas and begin at noon tomorrow. Kyiv quickly dismissed the announcement, calling it a trap, a Russian effort to buy time to rearm and mobilize more troops. Russia scholar Mark Galeotti also thinks the ceasefire is a purely symbolic gesture. We asked Galeotti about this and the string of recent successful Ukrainian assaults on Russian barracks, in particular about a New Year's Day attack on Russian troops in Makiivka, and what it tells us about the leadership of Russia's officer corps.
There are always going to be casualties in war. But nonetheless, the fact that a large number of soldiers had been congregated in what seemed to have been a barrack close to an ammunition dump, which again is something of a warning sign, many of whom were then using their telephones, because this was New Year's Eve and they were getting in touch with their families back home, which obviously provided a way in which their locations could be electronically pinpointed by the Ukrainians and then targeted. This is the sort of stuff which is basically, to put it crudely, a rookie mistake. And it says something about the degree to which actually a lot of the forces that are made up by mobilized reservists, in other words, people who had done their national service some years ago and then were called back up, are also being officered by people who likewise have just only recently been brought back from civilian life and who clearly don't have the kind of skills to be able to actually manage their deployments properly.
Now, you mentioned the mobile phone issue. I mean, the Russian Ministry of Defense says that's the main cause of the attack, was that the soldiers were using mobile phones. So they're essentially coming out and blaming their own troops for calling home on New Year's Eve. How does that explanation go over with the Russian public?
It's not going down well at all. And in particular, not so much with the general public, but with a certain fraction of the so-called sort of military bloggers, commentators on social media who now have sort of a massive audience. These are people who have a constituency within the military, within the security forces and so forth. Not huge numbers, but, you know, bluntly, people with uniforms and guns. And these are the people on whom Putin in the past has been able to rely and who are now increasingly critical of his regime.
So what effect does this have on Vladimir Putin? Does this hurt his credibility?
It does. Look, one individual case is not going to have a dramatic impact at this stage. It's more, though, that this becomes symbolic of wider issues. You know, he had in his New Year's Eve address, which is, you know, one of the kind of fixtures of Russian society, the family gets together ready to toast the new year. And before that happens, you watch the president's address. In the past, Putin has always presented himself as the, you know, fluffy father of the nation. He gives an upbeat talk about how it's going to be a great year and everyone should get together with their families. This time it was a very, very different speech. It was essentially all about the war. It was about the fact that times are going to be hard and the West is against us and such like. In that context, bit by bit, economic hardship, the casualties on the battlefield, the fear that, you know, there'll be new waves of mobilization and so forth. You know, all of this is combining to leave Russians increasingly disgruntled. The point is, at the moment, there's nothing they can do about it. Instead, Russians are turning off. They're not opposing Putin, but nor are they willing to support him anymore.
Does that give credence to the idea that was said a lot early on in the war, that once Russian casualties became known inside Russia to Russians themselves, then there would be a public outcry which would force Putin to change his war policy? Is there any reality to that idea now?
There is some reality, but there's also a lot of wishful thinking. This is a country of more than 140 million people. I mean, the casualties are horrific, but they are still relatively sustainable. It's all very well for there to be outcry in the sense of people sitting in their kitchens complaining to their friends. But in terms of actually organizing, you know, making protest movements, going out on the streets, it's incredibly hard to do so. So long as Putin has the support of the security apparatus, and as long as that security apparatus is united, then it's very hard for anyone to do anything. But that said, everything is getting that much more brittle. If we do get the kind of crisis that forces people onto the streets, which is more likely to be economic than political at this first stage, then it may well be that, as we saw in 1989 with the collapse of the Soviet puppet regimes in Eastern Europe, that in fact regimes which look very tough today can collapse very easily tomorrow. But as I said, that will take, I think, sort of much more pressure on the system. At the moment, frankly, Putin is in power and there's nothing people can do about it.
I'd like you to contrast Vladimir Putin's unusual New Year's Eve address with Volodymyr Zelensky's.
I think he has demonstrated this incredibly deft touch at dealing with different audiences, you know, with Ukrainians themselves, you know, rallying them together, keeping their morale high. With the West, encouraging and supporting those who want to, in due course, support Ukraine, and chastising and calling out those who he feels aren't properly supporting Ukraine. And thirdly, actually trying to reach out to Russians. I mean, this is the interesting thing, you know, Zelensky actually making a specific appeal to Russians, saying, look, this is not your war. Your boys are dying just simply for the vanity and ego of a dictator in the Kremlin. And also his defense minister, Alexei Reznikov, also made a personal appeal to Russians. And the fact that that ties in with a whole variety of other initiatives, such as, for example, trying to treat Russian prisoners of war very well and allowing them to ring their families back home and reassure them that they're safe. You know, all of these things that presents Ukraine as not what Putin is saying. Putin is trying to present Ukraine as this ghastly neo-fascist country that hates Russians and commits all kinds of atrocities. Anything that undermines that actually undermines Putin's war effort. And that's what Zelensky is managing to do.
Mark, what are you looking for in the next few months in terms of signs that one thing or another is happening in Ukraine?
So much depends on the spring offensives. It's clear that the Russians are building up their forces. They're not going to make much ground, I don't believe. But more than anything else, it's a signal to the West that this war is not going to end anytime soon. And are you still willing to be spending billions of dollars, euros and pounds every month propping up the Ukrainians and bankrolling this war? You know, Putin is essentially trying to win this war by breaking our will to support Ukraine. And meanwhile, the Ukrainians will be making their own spring offensives. Given that at the moment, neither side is willing to talk seriously about peace, because each side thinks that time is on its side. Kyiv believes it's going to be able to make more territorial gains. Moscow believes that actually we're going to start seeing divisions within the West. It all very much depends on these spring offensives.
Are there any conditions under which you can see an opportunity for a dialogue for peace?
We in the West cannot and should not be making any moves to basically surrender any part of Ukrainian sovereignty. But on the other hand, we can at the very least be talking to the Russians. Talking does not necessarily mean negotiating.
Is there any sign that the Biden administration or any other ally is in a conversation with Putin?
There are back-channel conversations that are taking place. Thank God, it has to be said, because after all, this could become a very escalatory process, if not. You know, we do know that the National Security Advisor has been in conversations with his Russian counterpart. We also know that there are arm's-length contacts through third parties, certain countries like Turkey, United Arab Emirates, and so forth, that do still have better connections with Moscow. So, yes, there are still contacts. But on the other hand, the trouble is, so long as they remain arm's length and covert, then there's a limit to really how seriously the Russians are going to take them.
Russia scholar Mark Galeotti is the author of many books, most recently Putin's Wars. He also hosts the podcast Moscow's Shadows. Thank you so much, Mark.
A pleasure.
You're with The World. China continues to report COVID data that is hard to believe, and that has scientists around the globe concerned.
The fact that we're not getting, we don't believe, the real data being reported in China is, you know, makes us all less safe.
The risk is of new variants developing and spreading. That's ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World, a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. This morning, President Biden spoke from the White House and addressed some immigration challenges facing the nation right now.
Today, my administration is taking several steps to stiffen enforcement for those who try to come without a legal right to stay, and to put in place a faster process, I emphasize a faster process, to decide a claim of asylum.
Biden said his administration will expand an existing program to accept up to 30,000 migrants each month from Cuba, Haiti, Nicaragua, and Venezuela. Julia Gillot was watching that speech. She's at the Migration Policy Institute in Washington. Julia, in broad strokes, how will today's announcement change things at the U.S.-Mexico border?
The announcement today really combines enforcement with new legal pathways. So there will be slots for up to 30,000 people from Venezuela, Haiti, Cuba, and Nicaragua to come to the United States through a process called parole. At the same time, that same number, up to 30,000 people from those countries, could be expelled under the Title 42 public health order at the border, so sent right back to Mexico as they approach the border.
So there's kind of two things going on here. One is, yes, we'll accept 30,000 migrants each month from these four countries, but if you don't have a compelling case, we will deport you back. Is that the idea?
That's right. If you don't come through this orderly process with advance permission, we'll send you back to Mexico.
The process is, as I understand it, people from these four countries, Cuba, Haiti, Nicaragua, and Venezuela, if they wish to come to the U.S., they must apply from their home countries first with a phone app, and they must have a sponsor in the U.S. Will these qualifications favor people from some of those countries over others?
The question is really who is able to find a sponsor in the United States and also who is able to meet the other requirements. There are more established communities in the U.S. from some of these countries than from others. For example, there's, of course, a big, strong Cuban community in the United States. So it does remain to be seen whether there will be sponsors for all of these groups. But the Venezuelan program has seen strong uptake and a lot of sponsors step forward. So that is a promising sign that there could be sponsors for these other programs as well.
So the 30,000 per month total from all these four countries, how does that compare to the number of people from these countries showing up at the U.S.-Mexico border every month?
In November of last year, so that's the latest month for which we have data, there were over 70,000 people who were encountered at the border from these four countries. So, of course, that's a bigger number. I think the theory is that with the Venezuelan program, as that program was implemented, the number of people coming to the border quickly decreased. So I think the administration is hoping that they'll see the same with the other countries now included in the program.
There are big political controversies here. One of them is the use of Title 42. That was a COVID health measure used by the Trump administration to bar migrants from entering the U.S. The White House was trying to eliminate its use, and now it's relying on Title 42. What does that say to you?
It is interesting to see the administration both working in court to be able to end the use of Title 42, but also now expanding its use. I think the administration has seen that it's a useful tool for managing migration at the border. So even while they want to project the sense that this isn't how they hope to manage the border, in the meantime, they're making use of the authority to do exactly that. Although they were quite clear today that they expect that the program will be ended either through their action or through court mandates and seem to be ready for a post-Title 42 world.
I guess one of my big questions is, you know, you said that the current number of people coming to the border is like, is it 70,000 a month?
It was over 70,000 in November, yes.
And this program will take up to 30,000 people from these four countries. From past experience, do these kind of measures actually help reduce the number of people trying to come across the border? Or is it just kind of it looks great, sounds great, but in practice doesn't really have an impact?
This is a bit of an experiment, so we'll have to see how it plays out. The Venezuelan program that was implemented in November led to a 90% drop in the number of Venezuelans approaching the U.S.-Mexico border. But it's not clear whether this new program will have the same impact. Those coming from Cuba, Haiti, and Nicaragua have more direct pathways to Mexico than Venezuelans did. So the impact could be different. We'll have to see how that plays out.
Julia Gillot is a senior policy analyst at the Migration Policy Institute. She's been helping us understand a change in policy at the U.S.-Mexico border affecting people coming from Cuba, Haiti, Nicaragua, and Venezuela. Thank you so much, Julia.
Thanks for having me.
World Health Organization officials are worried about new COVID variants spreading around the globe. There's another concern, too, China. Speaking yesterday in Geneva, the WHO's emergencies chief, Mike Ryan, said he doesn't trust the official reports from China.
We believe that the current numbers being published from China underrepresent the true impact of the disease in terms of hospital admissions, in terms of ICU admissions, and particularly in terms of deaths.
The world's most populous country dropped nearly all its COVID controls a month ago, and the coronavirus is now spreading fast. Chris Murray is the director of the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation in Seattle. Chris, what do you think is the likelihood that new variants are forming or spreading in China?
Well, there's always a risk of mutation and new variants. And so when you have millions and millions of infections, then we shouldn't be surprised if a new variant were to emerge. But probably it's not a huge risk because you have a population that is incredibly susceptible to getting infected. And so there's no selective pressure for a dramatically new variant that has immune escape in China, because Omicron and its sublineages will just spread like wildfire.
Hmm. A number of countries have put new testing requirements for travelers coming from China. Can that actually help, or is it too little too late?
Well, it's probably unlikely to help. The only justification for that is if we thought there was a new variant that was not an Omicron sublineage that would have immune escape, infect people that have immunity already, and we have no indication either from traveler sequencing or the CDC in China's reporting of genome sequencing to suggest that that's the case.
Now, according to the WHO's website, China is reporting a few hundred COVID deaths per week now. Where is that data from?
That's coming, I believe, from China CDC. We certainly don't believe that is the case. That would be really extraordinary, and there's no reason to think that there's some miraculous level of protection in a largely immunologically naive population in China. We look to what happened in Hong Kong at the beginning of 2022 when Omicron came into an immunologically naive population as some indication of what is likely to happen. And that was about 1 in 1,000 infections dying. So that would add up to hundreds of thousands of deaths in China, we expect, in the next few months.
What is the global impact of China's lack of transparency when it comes to COVID data?
You know, we're all safer when countries report cases, report hospitalizations particularly, and report deaths from COVID. It helps us detect when something anomalous is happening, when a new variant is spreading, or, you know, the thing that we fear the most, a new variant that is more severe were to show up. And so the fact that we're not getting, we don't believe, the real data being reported in China is, you know, makes us all less safe.
What variants are the most concerning to you right now in the world?
You know, our view of this is that all of the Omicron sublineages, so whether it's, you know, BA5, 7, XBB, et cetera, are not particularly concerning because they're Omicron, they have low infection fatality rates. And if one is replacing another because it's slightly more infectious, it's probably not an issue unless you're an immunologically naive population like China. And in fact, there's an argument to be made that, you know, ongoing Omicron sublineages sort of keep global immunity up, and that's good in case something came along that was much scarier, that had immune escape and was more severe.
What types of policies do you think would be best to limit the formation of more variants and their spread?
That is an extraordinarily tricky question. Because Omicron is so transmissible, it will just keep going. And in our models, we see this, that we're sort of approaching an Omicron essentially equilibrium, where we will, you know, as immunity wanes, whether from vaccination or recent infection, you keep producing people who can get infected. And Omicron is so transmissible, it'll eventually get to those people. Can you stop Omicron? No, we don't have the tools to do that. So our major strategy here has to be, you know, surveillance so that we detect the new severe variant if it ever occurs, and keeping those that are vulnerable, keeping their immunity up through boosters and making sure that antivirals are available for that group when they do get Omicron.
Lastly, Chinese officials have accused countries with new testing requirements of doing it for political reasons as opposed to public health reasons. COVID has long been politicized, but is there a basis to China's claim?
The only justification for the testing requirements is not that there is Omicron, you know, ripping through China, and that we might get Omicron coming back to the U.S., because we have plenty of Omicron in the U.S. right now. It's that there might already have been the emergence of a new variant. Now, the testing of people leaving China by various groups, and to the extent you believe it, the genomic sequencing reported by China CDC to WHO suggests there is no such variant yet available. And so it's really a risk calculus. Is there enough threat of a new variant in China that this testing should be put in place or not? And it's not clear. Yes, there's hundreds of millions of infections that are either have occurred or going to occur in China. But there's also hundreds of millions of infections around the world elsewhere, because Omicron just keeps going. If we're really worried about early detection of a new variant, the argument in that case should be that everybody should be tested.
If you were in charge of the whole world and the country's policies, would you have any testing requirements for Chinese travelers entering your country?
I don't think I would put my efforts there. I would put the efforts on comprehensive genome sequence monitoring globally so that if and when the scary variant, the immune escape with increased severity shows up, we know as soon as possible. That's the thing that will make a difference, because we're very vulnerable globally to the breakthrough variant that's more severe if it ever occurs.
Chris Murray is director of the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation in Seattle. Thanks, Chris.
No, thank you for your interest.
A deadly virus that infects cats has pet owners worried in Turkey. There's a drug that can cure it, but the pharmaceutical company that made it never sought approval for veterinary use. So cat owners are turning to illegal drug manufacturers, and those drugs come with a lot of risk and a big price tag. The World's Duri Buscarin reports from Istanbul.
Istanbul would not be Istanbul without its street cats. They jump on the tables of cafes and snooze in the window boxes. Retirees build apartment-style shelters so kittens have a warm place to sleep. When you have a lot of street cats, you get a lot of cat viruses. And perhaps the deadliest one is feline infectious peritonitis, or FIP.
He'd sort of just crawled into the cupboard and was lying at the bottom of the cupboard.
About 2 years ago, Amelia and her husband, Emre, noticed that their cat, Miskit, wasn't eating. Amelia had adopted Miskit as a kitten, and he had grown into a sweet-tempered tabby cat with a big white belly and a fondness for his food bowl. So when he stopped eating, they knew something was wrong. We'll only use their first names because the legality of what happened next is not so clear.
You know, whatever we could do, we were going to do.
After a series of tests, her veterinarian diagnosed Miskit with an almost certain case of FIP. Left untreated, she said, it would kill him.
The news that he wasn't going to survive for more than a few months was just crushing, and we were absolutely devastated.
The veterinarian explained that there is a medication available that works in about 90% of FIP cases, but they would have to buy it illegally. She gave Amelia and Emre a set of phone numbers written on a piece of paper. Each contact could sell them vials of an unlicensed drug, whose name is a big number, GS441524.
There was definitely this element of, can you trust these people? You know, you're giving them a lot of money. Is it going to work?
Originally developed by Gilead Sciences, GS441524 is chemically similar to remdesivir, one of the drugs used in COVID treatments. After proving that it worked, Gilead never pursued licensing for the cat version of the drug. In a statement, the company said that's because it's prioritizing treatments for humans. But other drug manufacturers got a hold of the recipe, and they now sell it in underground markets all over the world. Amelia and Emre found a seller who would send them vials of the GS drug through the mail. They would give Miskit injections at home, every day at the same time, for 3 months straight.
We didn't ever feel like it was wrong because, you know, at the end of the day, we were trying to save our cat's life. And, you know, this was a way, the only way that we could do that.
Sometimes the price would fluctuate, or their seller would run out, resulting in a scramble to find the drug for the next week. All told, Amelia and Emre estimate that they spent $2,500 on their treatments for Miskit. But after a couple of weeks, it actually started to work.
We just watched him walk to his food bowl, and it was just an amazing feeling, because that's just a sign of them feeling better, and you know that inside he's starting to feel better, and it just felt like a massive relief, and we just knew that we were doing the right thing then.
2 years later, Miskit is back to his old self. Amelia says she and her husband are grateful that he's alive, but frustrated that this is what they had to do to save their cat.
Which just felt so unfair to us and, you know, to all the animals and all the people that they can't afford to do it.
Meanwhile, the underground market for GS441524 keeps growing. At this veterinary clinic in a seaside suburb of Istanbul, Dr. Sezin Çitak calms a fluffy gray cat for a blood draw. FIP was always one of the saddest diagnoses to give a cat, Çitak says, because it's so fast and so deadly. When the GS drug came on the scene, it completely changed the game. It brought us so much happiness, she says. Within a week, the animals were starting to improve. Under Turkish law, vets are allowed to use experimental medications if there are no other options available, Çitak says. At her clinic, cat owners buy the GS drug on their own and bring it to the clinic for shots. Her colleague, Hasan Musayev, shows me a collection of small vials of a clear liquid where the manufacturers seem to have added labels to avoid legal trouble.
In this one, they write for external use only, but in some of them, they write on the flacon, it's forbidden.
He says he has no idea which countries the drugs are coming from, but Çitak says the treatments give her hope for all the sick cats she sees. Even though it's expensive, at least there's some kind of a solution, she says. For the world, I'm Derya Buzgarin in Istanbul.
No Palestinian prisoner has done more time in an Israeli prison than Karim Yunus. He was convicted of murdering an Israeli soldier in the Golan Heights in 1980 and started serving his prison sentence in 1983. But before the sun rose yesterday, he was released from a prison just north of Tel Aviv. He used a passersby cell phone to tell his family he was out. The absence of fanfare, it turns out, was part of the Israeli plan. For more on who Karim Yunus is and what his release means, we turn to Khaled Al-Gindi of the Middle East Institute. First, who is Karim Yunus?
Well, Karim Yunus is actually a Palestinian citizen of Israel, and he served a 40-year prison sentence. What's interesting, actually, is that he was supposed to have been released a decade ago as part of a U.S.-brokered prisoner release deal that was brokered by Secretary of State John Kerry. And it was the refusal to release Karim, among others, was what ultimately led to the collapse of those negotiations.
Why was Karim Yunus released?
He had served his term. So it may simply be that his term expired.
His pre-dawn release yesterday was on purpose. What was the thinking there, and who was behind that decision?
The new national security minister, Itamar Ben-Gvir, explicitly issued orders to the family to not mark his release in any public way. They didn't want the spectacle of, you know, other Palestinian citizens of Israel celebrating the release of one of their own, which would be an embarrassment, frankly, for what is supposed to be a very hardline government.
Is what they did unusual, though, when Palestinian prisoners are typically released? Are they released to their family?
In most cases, there is a downplaying of the release. They're dropped off someplace. They're not driven to their homes. They're just sort of fend for themselves. It's not unusual for them to be released in the middle of the night or, you know, in the pre-dawn hours or at some time in which there can't be a major gathering.
And is it typical for there to be celebrations when Palestinian prisoners are released?
A million Palestinians have been arrested at some point in their lives. And so it's an issue that touches almost every Palestinian family. It's seen as a huge sacrifice, right? It's just short of the ultimate sacrifice.
But in this case, he was convicted of murdering an Israeli soldier.
Right.
Are Palestinian prisoners celebrated and revered even when they commit serious crimes?
It's a matter of perspective. But attacking an armed soldier in occupied territory, international observers and even international legal experts would say that's not a crime.
But isn't there another side to that, too? I mean, does the all-embracing view of Palestinian prisoners by Palestinians interfere with mutual understanding and peacemaking between Israelis and Palestinians?
Sure. I mean, there's no question that some number, some portion of the thousands and thousands of Palestinian prisoners are actual terrorists who have done terrible things like killed civilians. I think it would be very difficult to make the case that all Palestinian prisoners are are guilty of even what they're charged with, just given the fundamental unfairness of the system that convicted them.
Now, there seems to be a strange plot twist here. Israel's new Minister of National Security, Itamar Ben-Gvir, you mentioned him. He's a far-right politician. He was once interviewed by the press in his home with a poster of Baruch Goldstein on the wall behind him, and Goldstein killed 29 Palestinians while they were worshiping. And as a lawyer, Ben-Gvir has represented Israeli extremists. How can we understand his policymaking in the Karim Yunis case in terms of the decision to release a Palestinian convicted of murdering an Israeli soldier?
There wasn't a lot he could do. I think if it were up to him personally, he certainly wouldn't want to see Karim Yunis released. He has advocated for much harsher treatment of Palestinian prisoners. He wants to loosen open fire regulations when it's acceptable to use deadly fire against Palestinian protesters. Otherwise, I think it's not something he would want to do.
Khaled Al-Gindi is an expert on Palestinian and Israeli affairs at the Middle East Institute. Khaled, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
This is Portuguese musician Ana Lua Caiano. She's 23 years old and keeping very busy. But
I realize, okay, I need to do one thing at a time. There's time.
From installation art projects to working on independent films, Ana Lua Caiano always seems to be creating something. Over the past year, though, her primary focus has been on music. Ana Lua Caiano is the next generation of Portuguese musicians to help define what Portuguese music is and wants to be. For her, it's a mix of electronic music and also traditional folk. Not necessarily fado, that's the most popular form of Portuguese music from the 19th and 20th century. Caiano is talking about sounds that go back much further.
I'm talking more about the music that is not recorded or is not intellectual.
It's the musical rhythms that came from when Portugal was an empire, like sounds from Angola and Mozambique, Brazil, and other parts of South America. Ana Lua Caiano also uses more modern sounds, like a beatbox and drum machines. She says the feedback she's received from traditionalists of past generations has been positive.
I've had very good reactions from the people that are older, and say that they really like the way I use the tradition. Maybe some of them that don't speak to me don't like that much, but fortunately I have had a lot of good feedback from that generation, yeah.
Ana Lua Caiano creating and updating Portuguese music for the 21st century with a nod to Portugal's diverse past. Her latest album is Cheguei Tarde Ontem, or I Arrived Late Yesterday. E tinha andado escrito, gravado e gritado. Que ontem foi quinta-feira e era ontem um jantar. E tinha andado escrito, gravado e gritado. Que ontem foi quinta-feira e era ontem um jantar. And that's all for us today on The World. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Join us again tomorrow for another spin of the world. Cheguei tarde ontem, cedo para amanhã. Ando atrás de quinta-feira, ando dia atrás. Andamos sempre dia atrás, nós atrás de outro dia. Cheguei tarde ontem. From PRX.